is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. As the presidential campaign has settled into insults and hints of bodily harm that are then called the exaggerations of an anti-Trump media or just inexplicable lunacy from a young Trump supporter plucked off the side of Trump Tower, here are some of the things you may have missed in the Middle East. Syrian rebels have broken the Assad regime's hold on Aleppo, and Russia has opened a tiny ceasefire window for delivering relief supplies. 2 million people without water or food, mocking the UN scheduled truce scheduled for later this month. In Libya, relentless fighting in the hometown of former dictator Muammar al-Qaddafi. Sirte has been liberated by essentially being demolished. A pattern seen in Aleppo, Fallujah, Ramadi, and parts of Baghdad. ISIS struck deep inside Baghdad this week. A fire that broke out in a maternity ward in a Baghdad hospital killed 13 infants. In this region, invaded by the U.S. in 2003, and then which experienced a wave of what looked like freedom in a bitterly recalled Arab Spring in 2010, today the repressive so-called Islamic State is among the biggest players in the region, so unfulfilled by promises of democracy from George W. Bush and other American policymakers. As Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump await CIA security briefings later this week, is this statement by Donald Trump an outlandish cheap shot?
President Obama, he is the founder of ISIS. He's the founder of ISIS, okay? He's the founder.
Of course, it's distorted hyperbole from the master. But there may yet be people in ISIS who might go along with the spirit of that statement. This week, a special issue of the New York Times Magazine takes up the region, the Middle East, the recent history of U.S. invasion and U.S. withdrawal. Stories of six unforgettable characters. Sunday's issue is comprised of a single story by reporter Scott Anderson entitled Fractured Lands, featuring stunning photographs by Paolo Pellegrini from deep inside places that Anderson believes for an instant grasp the possibility of hope, only to see it traded for a futureless savagery.
There's 22 Arab countries, and when the Arab Spring started in 2011, they were all affected to some degree. But if you look at the three nations that you would say are truly failed, Iraq, Syria, and Libya today, what they all have in common is they were all cobbled together by the Western powers at the end of World War I. They're all kind of artificial states. And oddly enough, they were all totalitarian regimes. They were not monarchies. So I think what happened when the Arab Spring came along was you're talking about countries with a very fragile sense of national identity. So when the strongman is overthrown, or in the case of Assad in Syria holding on by his fingernails, where people's primary loyalties go to is to tribe or to clan or to their sectarian affiliation.
And how does that explain Egypt? Because there is a very strong national association in Egypt. I mean, Egyptians proudly claim their nationality.
That's it. No, and Egypt is the exception. But to me, the most appalling moment in Egypt was you had Mohamed Morsi, the Muslim Brotherhood president, democratically elected. Within 1 year, some of the same people that had been in Tahrir Square advocating the overthrow of Mubarak were out in the streets 2 years later advocating the overthrow of Mohamed Morsi and asking for the military to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and to me, that was this pivotal moment in the history of the Middle East of, okay, they say they want democracy. Here they have it. It's an imperfect one. Morsi had his own problems. But now you're asking for the military to come back in. I think that was just a really kind of astonishing moment.
We're giving the impression that this is some sort of big picture look at what went on in the Middle East. And in fact, you've chosen six amazing characters who have very different points of view. How did you select these characters to tell the story?
Yeah, I think for most viewers, most readers, the whole region blends together a little bit of what's happening in Syria, what's happening in Iraq. So the idea was to find people from these countries and to tell the history, the story of the past 15 years through their lives and their experiences. Two of the characters are from Iraq. One is from Kurdistan, Syria, Libya, and Egypt. And in every case, these are not extraordinary people. They're not famous people. But extraordinary things have happened to them.
In Libya, it seems that the Arab Spring consisted of excising Muammar Gaddafi, and that was all that was required. Describe how the Libyan situation is both the same as the rest of the tragedy that you speak of, and your character, Majdi al-Mangush.
Majdi is it's an amazing figure. He was an Air Force cadet in Gaddafi's Air Force when the Libyan Revolution started in February of 2011. He and his fellow cadets were kept on basically a military compound for 3 months, kept in quarantine, and had no idea what was happening around them. Believe the regime's story that, oh, this is foreign mercenaries coming in. It's not the Libyan people. And so for 3 months, he had no idea of what was happening outside of these compound walls. So for the regime, he agreed to sneak back into his hometown and to find who the rebel leadership was, and then to report back to the Gaddafi regime who the leadership were so they could be targeted for assassination. And of course, he discovers everything he's been told for 3 months is a lie. It's not foreign mercenaries. In fact, it's his own family in Misrata who's joined the rebellion. And he does this amazing kind of sting operation where he gets, you know, he's going in as a regime spy. He kind of sets up his regime handler in Misrata, and he joins the rebels. For Majdi, where he saw that the revolution had failed, and it's very interesting that it was such a kind of a subtle thing. He got his diploma from the Air Force Academy saying, you're an engineer. You've completed all your requirements. And he said, oh, but I hadn't. I hadn't gone. There had been no classes for a year and a half through the revolution. And what he said about that is like, that to me just proved that everything now in Libya is lies and corruption. And when I got that diploma, I could have gone off and passed myself off as an engineer, but I wouldn't know what I was doing. And that to him was, this is when I knew that Libya was a failed state.
What's his future?
He's determined to stay in Libya. He's back in the town of Misrata, which is probably one of the better off cities in Libya. And ISIS is not in the immediate vicinity of Misrata. But what Majdi probably doesn't fully appreciate is that by all reckoning, Libya is going to run out of money in about a year from now. All its foreign reserves are going to be depleted. So Libya is headed for this economic brick wall on top of the militias, on top of the political crisis in the country. You can just look at your calendar and know that about a year from now, Libya is going to be another huge world concern.
Iraq, of course, is at the center of U.S. involvement in the region. And Khulod al-Zaidi is an individual who has such a huge stake in the future of Iraq.
Yeah, Khulod, she's an amazing woman. She was the youngest girl of a family of six from a provincial city in southern Iraq, very traditional. And when the Americans invaded in 2003, it was like an epiphany to her. Americans came in talking about, you know, women's empowerment, democracy, respect for human rights. And when the Americans left, Khulod continued to try to do these women empowerment projects to the point where the militias started coming after her, and they threatened to kill her. She finally, after a couple of very close calls, went into exile in Jordan. And she was seen as so in danger by the UN Refugee Agency. She got this emergency resettlement status. She came to the United States in 2008. But the Americans wouldn't let her family, the part of the family she had brought to Jordan with her. So she went back to Jordan. And she spent the next 9 years in Jordan just stuck. And that's where I met her.
Bitter? Angry?
Only once in all the time I've known her did she ever kind of fall into something close to self-pity. And it was when she was in Jordan and she said, you know, I have no future here. I try not to blame anybody for what's happened, but I just really wish the Americans had thought more closely before they had come into Iraq. And she said, that's what started everything. You know, without that, we would be normal.
How do you feel about that as an American journalist?
It's played out in different ways, but I don't think the American experience or misadventure in Iraq is really that unique. I think this fits a longstanding American foreign policy tradition that we decide we're going into a place. We always see ourselves as the liberators. We're never the invaders or the occupiers. When it doesn't work out, we kind of pick up and run.
I remember after 9/11 being told by the Bush administration and others that the way we needed to protect ourselves was to deny sanctuary in rogue, chaotic states. It seems like if we're just talking in terms of square mileage of rogue state sanctuary potential,
the last 13 years have increased that by an order of magnitude.
Yes, it's a rogue region now.
It's a rogue region.
Yeah, it's, you know, this is absolutely ground zero of the world's geopolitical concerns now and for the foreseeable future, and yet it's become so dangerous to work there that it's almost ignored. The New York Times has a policy they won't send somebody into Syria. You can go in on the government side, but you can't go in on the rebel side. So with the rise of terrorism and the kind of indiscriminate violence you see in a place like Syria, it's becoming really difficult for journalists to even cover these places.
Is there something that you didn't know in all of your experience that you come away from this whole reporting project with?
It almost sounds a bit trite to say, but I think I was reminded again of just the resiliency of people in these situations. Khaled al-Zaidi in Iraq, such a strong, dynamic personality that was able to save her own family against all odds. So I think that while I may be pessimistic about the region in general, I think that my relationships with the characters has made me more kind of optimistic on an individual level.
The humans will survive.
Yes.
The political organization is a mess and will have to resolve itself in other ways.
That's right.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, John.